So I'd like to tell you about some work I've done recently, which has led to a new endpoint for Hawking evaporation. A paper with some more details came out on the web a couple months ago. So this new endpoint is a result of some recent developments in string theory. So let me begin by just telling you about some of the ingredients of string theory that I'll need to use. As you all know, string theory starts with the idea that elementary particles are not really point-like, but excitations of a one-dimensional string. When you quantize a string, you're led to higher spatial dimensions, supersymmetry, and a new length scale, which I'll call L sub s, the string length, which is set by the tension of these one-dimensional strings. Now, it turns out that when the space-time curvature is of order the string scale, the metric is no longer well-defined. There's large quantum fluctuations, and so the metric is no longer meaningful. We're used to the idea in quantum gravity that the metric should stop being well-defined when the curvature is the Planck scale. Here, there's something associated with the string which fuzzes out the metric sooner. The string length is bigger than the Planck length, and so at a smaller curvature, the string scale curvature, the metric ceases to be well defined. Another fact I'll need is that strings carry charge. So there is an analog of a Maxwell field, which has now three indices. It's an antisymmetric tensor, a three-form H. And in general space-time dimension, in d space-time dimensions, you can surround a string with a d minus 3 sphere, and the charge is measured by doing this integral of the dual of h, a d minus 3 form, over this d minus 3 sphere. This is the direct generalization of how you would measure the charge of a charged particle in four dimensions. There you have a two-form f, usually. The particle is surrounded by a two-sphere, and you just integrate the dual of f over the two-sphere. If you had a charged particle in d dimensions, you could still surround it by a sphere, which now has d minus 2 dimensions. You fix time, and you fix a radius. You have a d minus 2 sphere, and you would integrate the dual of f over that d minus 2 sphere. A string is a one-dimensional extended object. When you surround it by a sphere, you fix time, you fix a radius, and you fix a position some point along the string. So you actually go down one more dimension. It's a d minus 3 sphere that you surround the string with, and you need a d minus 3 form, which is just the dual of this 3 form, which is carrying the charge of the string. Now, if space happens to have one direction, which is compactified into a circle, there are sort of new states of the string. In addition to the usual states where the string is just moving around the circle, you can now have states in which the string winds around the circle. Also, when you have a circle in space and fermions, as we do because of the supersymmetry, there is a question of what the boundary condition are on the fermions when they go around the circle. The fermions can either be periodic, coming back to themselves, or antiperiodic, coming back to minus themselves. If the fermions are periodic, okay, then these winding modes always have positive mass, as you would expect. There's a finite tension, and you stretch out the string a certain amount. However, if the fermions are antiperiodic, something unusual happens. These winding modes have positive mass when the circle is large, but when the circle approaches the string scale, these winding modes become massless, and when the circle is less than the string scale, they actually become tachyonic. They have a negative mass squared. Now, the last fact that I'm going to need from string theory is that the topology of space can change. And here's a very recent example, which I'll be using shortly. Imagine that you have a situation where there's a circle in space which has a neck. The circle sort of comes down to a smaller radius here than it is out in the rest of the space. Well, as I just told you, there are these winding strings which can go around this neck. And if you have antiperiodic boundary conditions for the circle, these winding strings will become tachyonic when the size of the circle shrinks below the string scale. Now, the existence of these tachyons has been known for a long time, for more than 20 years. But it was only this year that Eva Silverstein and her collaborators showed what happens when you sort of follow this instability. The tachyon indicates some sort of instability in the space. And when you follow that instability, or what people call condensing the tachyon, they showed that the result of that instability is that the neck pinches off. So you go from this connected space with a neck, that actually the circle pinches off, and you get a disconnected space, a kind of topology change in string theory. So that's the background. Those are the facts about string theory that I'm going to be using. And now let me talk about the endpoint of Hawking evaporation. But before I say anything about a new endpoint, let me remind you what the old endpoints were. So back in the 1970s, after Hawking showed that black holes will evaporate, people thought that they would evaporate down to the Planck scale. They would evaporate semi-classically until the curvature got to be of order the Planck scale. And at that point, the semi-classical methods that were used to do the calculation broke down. And one couldn't really say anything about the final state past this Planck scale black hole. If the black hole had charge, and this charge could not be radiated away in Hawking evaporation, then the black hole would evaporate toward extremality. Well, in the 1990s, there was another possibility which arose. Susskind first suggested, and Joe Polchinski and I made more precise, the idea that black holes will evaporate down to the point where the curvature is of order the string scale. At that time, the metric stops being well-defined in string theory, and it was suggested that this sort of string scale black hole turns into just an excited string state in an essentially flat space-time, or in a space-time with no horizon. So the black hole evaporates until it has string scale curvature and then becomes some excited string state, which can then decay. Excited strings can decay to unexcited strings. And a check of this idea was in terms of the entropy. If you ask, you take the mass of the black hole when its curvature is of order the string scale, and ask how many string states do you have of that mass, you find that the number of string states available is of the order, the exponential of the black hole entropy, this Bekenstein-Hawking entropy. Now, in this case, which applies to all black holes, Schwarzschild, Reiser, Nordström, everything, we are not able to actually compute the numerical factor, the 1/4, in the entropy, but we do get the right agreements in terms of the dependence of the entropy on the mass and charge and things like that. So that was the understanding until recently. And this new endpoint is, well, as currently understood, applies to a five-dimensional generalization of a black hole, something that's called the black string. So a black string is simply a one-dimensional extended object surrounded by an event horizon. So the horizon topology is, in general, a sphere across R or a sphere across S1 if space is compactified and the black string is just wrapping around around this circle. And I should point out that this should be distinguished from what's called black rings, which I think you'll hear more about tomorrow. Black rings is the name used for an object with horizon topology, well, I guess the one that's known as S2 cross S1, but those live in an uncompactified space. So those are like a toroidal black hole sitting in an uncompactified space. These black rings are straight, and they just wrap around a compact circle. Well, the simplest example of a black string is simply the usual four-dimensional Schwarzschild black hole cross a circle. That's a five-dimensional Ricci flat metric with a horizon with the topology S2 cross S1. That's the neutral black ring, not neutral black string, no charges. We want to consider a charged generalization of this, and those are solutions to a theory with an action that I've written down here. This comes from string theory, but basically it's gravity coupled to this 3 form that I've already mentioned and another scalar called the dilaton, and the action governing it is written here. This is the theory we'll be focusing on for this talk. You can, of course, rescale it so it has a standard Einstein action if you want, but this is one form of the action. So you can find explicit solutions to this theory describing charged black strings. And in general d dimensions, the metric is given here. It depends on two functions of R, this function h1 and a function f. You'll see that it is static, nothing dependent on time. It's translationally invariant along the string. So x is a coordinate running along the string, which I'll take to be a periodic coordinate. So this will be an s1. And it's spherically symmetric around the string. These functions, h1 and f, are written here. So f is just 1 minus r, some constant r0 to the n over r to the n, where n is just d minus 4. And h1 is 1 plus this constant, another parameter, alpha, over r to the n. So there's two parameters, r0 and alpha, in the solution. And they give you the mass and charge of the black string. So physically, these parameters correspond to the mass and charge in terms of formulas I've written here. R0 is also the horizon of this black string. Now, there's an extremal limit, the sort of maximum charge you can have for a given mass, maybe the maximum minimum mass you can have for a given charge is obtained by taking a limit in which R0 goes to 0, alpha goes to infinity, but this combination is held fixed. That keeps the charge fixed and gives you the extremal limit. Yes, Michael?
So I think of this, we're still in the string frame, so I should think of this in string units?
This is the string frame metric, exactly. Yeah.
Can you say a word about what the dilaton part of the action is?
Yes. Yeah, so the dilaton, which I didn't write here, is also determined just by this function h1. And it's something like e to the phi is h1, or maybe 1 over h1, or something like that. Yeah.
When you gave the formula for the mass and the charge, well, the charge, I guess, doesn't care about the conformal frame. The mass is the ADM mass in the Einstein frame?
It is the ADM mass, and that actually doesn't depend on the frame either. The formula for the ADM mass in the string frame is not the usual formula. There's extra contributions coming from the derivatives of the dilaton. But if you write down the correct formula, you get the same mass as you would in the Einstein frame.
Is the charge given as a free form is something completely new. I mean, it has no analogous in the classical physics.
It's not something we've seen before. It's definitely associated with these one-dimensional objects. If you ask what's the natural charge that a one-dimensional object can carry, it's this thing. It's this three-form generalization of the Maxwell field. So at this point, you can think of it as just an ordinary classical tensor field, and it is sourced by these strings.
Appear at another level. I mean, it doesn't appear at another scale, the string scale.
Well, it appears, I mean, this is a solution which can have low curvature, you know, no string scale curvature, you know, anywhere outside the horizon. And the three form is not zero, and it's giving this charge. So, okay. So under Hawking radiation, the when this black string evaporates, as it will, the R0, the sort of horizon, shrinks. Alpha increases, but this charge is fixed. So it sort of approaches extremality. Now, the point I want to focus on is...
How do you know that alpha increases?
What's that?
Are you saying this is what happens? How does one know that?
OK, that follows just from the fact that the black hole, the black string, has to lose mass.
Right.
And the charge can't get radiated away. And the reason charge can't get radiated away is because this charge can be thought of as the winding charge of sort of the strings that sort of collapse to form it. And we're going to compactify x on a large circle. In fact, let x at infinity have length L. And so a string which wraps around that circle is going to be very massive. And it will be very rare to produce that compared to all the massless radiation it can produce. OK, so let's suppose the circle has length L at infinity. Notice that this function h which, if we turn off the charge, right, if alpha is 0, q is 0, this is 0, and we just have the neutral black string. This is the product of Schwarzschild in d minus 1 dimensions cross a circle. So that's the metric when H1 isn't there. When you have a charge, you get this extra factor. And you notice this factor is increasing. When you come in from infinity it's 1 at infinity, it's infinite at r equal to 0, which is the singularity. And it just monotonically increases when you come in. So 1 over h is decreasing. And that means the length of the circle is decreasing monotonically from L at infinity down to 0 at the singularity. It's just a property of the solution. And of course, we're going to use that. Now, but let's first check how the curvatures are scaling. The curvature at the horizon is set by the size of the horizon. So that's set by this parameter r0. Curvature is roughly 1 over r0 squared. So that'll be the string scale when r0 reaches the string length. But as I said, if x is periodic with period L, the size of the circle at the horizon is smaller than L. It's L over cosh alpha, because if you just look at H1, I should also emphasize this H has nothing to do with the 3 form. This is just some harmonic function, H1. It's not the 3 form. So H1, when R is equal to the R0, when it's at the horizon, this is cosh squared. So the length of the circle is shrunk by a factor of cosh alpha. So clearly, since r0 and alpha are independent parameters in the solution, there are situations where this circle reaches the string scale when the curvature at the horizon is still very small, much less than the string scale curvature. Now, if the circle has antiperiodic fermions, the tachyon instability associated with these winding modes will set in. That tachyon instability, as I said, causes this circle to pinch off. And so you form a new object. The horizon is gone. The singularity that was inside is gone. And what you form is a Kaluza-Klein bubble of nothing. OK, so let me tell you what this bubble of nothing is all about. Back in 1981, Witten showed that the standard Kaluza-Klein vacuum, four-dimensional Minkowski space cross a circle, was unstable to a non-perturbative quantum gravitational instability. In particular, what he showed is that there's a gravitational instanton which mediates a decay of this Minkowski space cross a circle into another solution with the same mass. So it has zero mass, and it's a bubble in which the S1, the circle, pinches off at a finite radius. So there's no space-time inside, and the bubble rapidly expands out and hits null infinity.
Why do you say that this is unstable, Gary? Is that because of the fact that this property that it expands out to infinity, or is there something?
Oh, it's quantum mechanically unstable just because it doesn't persist, right? If there's an instanton which causes this to decay to something, then if you wait long enough, this space, which was originally flat space cross a circle, is going to turn into one of these bubbles. So it's not a sort of perturbative or linearized instability. It's one of these quantum gravitational instabilities. So a way to think about the geometry is just the following. So you start with R3, say a flat R3, and you take out a ball in the center. So that space has a boundary, which is just the 2-sphere. And now you use the fact that over each point is a circle, and you arrange it so that the circle smoothly pinches off as you come into this 2-sphere. So this results in a space which has no inner boundary. If you come in, you just end up going back out on the other side of the circle. There's a minimal 2-sphere. Okay, you've changed the topology, introduced these minimal spheres, and there's clearly nothing inside this minimal sphere. There's no radius, no space inside. So that's the bubble of nothing. And in fact, Witten's solution is easily obtained by analytically continuing the five-dimensional Schwarzschild metric. So if you just write down the five-dimensional Schwarzschild black hole, which I've done here in terms of the function f, 1 minus r0 squared over r squared, this is just the 3-sphere. So this is the usual spherically symmetric five-dimensional black hole. Now you analytically continue, and you set t equal to I times chi. That just gives you the Euclidean five-dimensional black hole. But you also analytically continue one of the angles on the sphere. So theta can be set to pi over 2 plus I tau. That turns this 3-sphere into 3-dimensional de Sitter space. Well, as usual, when you analytically continue this time in the black hole to chi, chi has to be periodically identified to avoid a conical singularity at R0. So asymptotically, when you do this, you get Kaluza-Klein boundary conditions. The original metric was asymptotically flat in 5 dimensions, but the new chi is periodic. And so I've just done that analytic continuation, written the metric here. And this asymptotically is flat space cross a circle. But since f goes to 0 at r equal to r0, and it smoothly pinches off there, this metric only exists for larger values of r. There's a minimal 2-sphere at r equal to r0, which is the bubble. Its area initially at tau equal to 0 is just 4 pi r0 squared. But as time evolves, you can see this grows exponentially. The bubble spans out. Now, it turns out that that solution that Witten found is just the tip of the iceberg. If you ask for 5-dimensional vacuum solutions which have that same bubble geometry, you can find lots of them. So I claim that there are, for a given size circle at infinity, if you fix this L at infinity, vacuum bubbles exist in all sizes. In particular, there's a static bubble. The static bubble is what you would get if you just take 4-dimensional Euclidean Schwarzschild, 4-dimensional Schwarzschild analytically continued to get the standard Euclidean black hole, and you take the product of that in time. That's a static solution with the geometry of the bubble, and it has positive mass. Oh, I should have mentioned that the feature that Witten used, that this solution has zero mass, is also immediate. Since the metric asymptotically is Kaluza-Klein with a finite circle, the mass should be a 1 over r correction to the metric, as it usually is for asymptotically flat spacetimes in 4 dimensions. And you just look. There's no 1 over r term in the metric here. So this clearly has zero mass. If you do the 4-dimensional Schwarzschild cross time, that does have a 1 over r term. You get a bubble with finite mass, positive mass, and it's static. But it's unstable. A bubble a little bit smaller than that will collapse, will actually contract down, and larger ones expand. This is just like decay of the false vacuum in field theory. You can have bubbles of true vacuum inside a false vacuum, and they have similar properties. Now, Witten's bubble has zero mass. When you make bubbles bigger than that, they have negative mass. There's no positive mass theorem for these bubble geometries. And it's interesting to ask why. We have two different types of proofs for the positive mass theorem in 4 dimensions. Spinorial proof that Witten introduced and the original Schoen-Yau proof. And both of them fail, but they fail for different reasons. So the Witten proof fails because he requires a spinner which is asymptotically constant at infinity. And it turns out that spinners in these bubble geometries are always antiperiodic around the S1 at infinity. So you can't apply Witten's proof. Now, the Schoen-Yau proof requires that if you take the 2-sphere at infinity, you can fill it in with some 3-surface. And then they use some minimal surface type arguments. But in these bubble geometries, the S2 at infinity is not the boundary of any 3-surface. There's just there's a minimal S2. So both of the proofs fail. And in fact, the result is simply false. OK, so this is the new endpoint of Hawking evaporation. When you take one of these charged black strings, it evaporates toward extremality. The size of the circle at the horizon shrinks. And when it reaches the string scale, you get this instability in string theory due to these winding modes. And that will cause the circle to pinch off, and you produce a Kaluza-Klein bubble of nothing. Now, the first question you have to ask when you hear something like this is, where does the entropy go? Because the black string can still have a lot of entropy at the point when the circle is the string scale. And a bubble has no intrinsic entropy at all. It's just a particular classical solution. And the answer is that you never produce just a bubble. You always produce a bunch of radiation as well as the bubble. And the entropy goes into the radiation. So we can write down several properties of bubbles that bubbles must have when they're the endpoint of Hawking evaporation. The first property is that the mass of the bubble must be less than the mass of the black string. That's just because of what I said, that the bubble, that there has to be energy left over, which produces the radiation, which can carry away the entropy. So that's one property we need. Another property is that the size of the bubble should be the same, should be equal to the size of the spheres, the spherical cross-sections of the horizon. That's because the horizon is a sphere across the circle. The circle is getting very small and pinching off. But it's doing it sort of locally or independently at each point around the sphere. We don't expect this tachyon process to change the area of the big sphere that we started with. But that sphere becomes the bubble. When the circle pinches off, that is our bubble. And so we expect the size of the bubble to equal the size of that spherical cross-section of the horizon. A third property is that these bubbles must carry a charge, because the original black string had a charge, and charge should be conserved. It can't just disappear. So this is a qualitative difference between the bubbles I'm going to talk about now and Witten's bubble, for example, and the vacuum bubbles I was just mentioning. Those were all, of course, vacuum solutions. There was no charge. These bubbles are going to have a charge. And finally, the size of the circle at infinity should not, of course, be affected by what's happening down near the horizon when this circle pinches off. So the size at infinity for the bubble should be the same as what we had originally for the black string. OK, so now to describe these bubbles in more detail, it's convenient to, first of all, consider a string in six dimensions. I had general dimensions on the previous slide, but let's focus on d equals 6. And I'm also going to add, the reason d equals 6 is nice is that you now have this d minus 3 sphere is again a 3 sphere. So that means strings in six dimensions, in addition to this electric type charge that all strings can carry, there's now a magnetic type charge. You can define a charge which is just the integral of the 3 form directly over the 3 sphere and not its dual. So you can have strings which have both an electric and magnetic charge associated with this 3 form. The reason that's an advantage is if you set the electric and magnetic charge as equal, this dilaton, the scalar, is just constant and completely decouples. So just to simplify life, I'm going to sort of take the dilaton out of the picture and just work with this metric which has both an electric and magnetic charge. And you'll notice that it looks very similar to the one I wrote down before. This sort of part of the metric is exactly the same in terms of time and the direction along the string. And this part is very similar, but now this factor, this function h, which is what I called h1 before, but let's just call it h here, it just appears multiplying this part of the metric as well as multiplying that part. That's the only difference. But this is a solution with constant dilaton and this 3 form having equal electric and magnetic charges. OK. Well, because this part of the metric is the same as before, the fact that the circle is shrinking as you come in is exactly as before. If x has period L at infinity, it's going to get smaller as you come in because h is getting bigger. And once again, when it reaches a string scale, the tachyon should convert this into a bubble. Now, it turns out to be very easy to write down exact solutions describing static charged bubbles. And you do it by just a simple analytic continuation of this metric. Static bubbles with the same charges can be obtained by simply setting the time in the black hole equal I times some spatial coordinate y, and x. Rather than worrying about the sphere and getting expanding bubbles, we have another spatial coordinate here, which is not doing anything. We can analytically continue x into our new time coordinate. And we get this metric, which I've just written here. As before, since we are analytically continuing time and f goes to 0 at r0, this metric only exists for r bigger than r0. And r0 is the location of the bubble. Our circles in this y direction pinch off there. The 3 form, this is an analytic continuation of the metric. It turns out the 3 form is totally unchanged. It solves the equations for the same 3 form. And well, I said the dilaton was decoupling here, but in the more complicated solution, when I had unequal charges and a non-constant dilaton, the dilaton wouldn't be changed either. So here's a static bubble. And now we can ask, does it satisfy our conditions? And in fact, the first three conditions are automatically satisfied. So let's just see why that's true. The first condition was that the bubble should have mass less than the black string. Well, we have two solutions, and we can compute their masses and compare them. Well, it turns out that the mass of this black string, not surprisingly, is always greater than the mass of the extremal black string with the same charges. So there's some mass with some charge fix, there's some extremal mass, and this mass is always bigger. The bubble, on the other hand, turns out to have a mass which is always less than the mass of this extremal black string. So it certainly always has mass less than this non-extremal string. Okay, so this does have less mass than the original black string, so that's good. Second property, the size of the bubble should equal the horizon size. Well, that is clear because originally the horizon was at r equal to r naught, and its area was not just 4 pi r naught squared because there's this factor h in front, but it's given by this radius r naught. Similarly here, this is our bubble. The bubble is r equal to r naught, and the area of the sphere is exactly the same. So that's good. The third property is that the charge should be unchanged. And that follows just from the fact that the 3-form is unchanged. So it will give us the same charge for the bubble. But there's something very interesting about this charge on the bubble. Q is unchanged, but there's no longer any source for the charge. In the case of the black string, you could imagine that the charge, the source, was sitting at the singularity. You collapse down a bunch of winding strings, and you produce this object. And the charge was sort of sitting there inside the horizon. But now there is no singularity. And so what's carrying the charge is just this non-trivial flux on this non-contractible, on this, say, minimal three-sphere. And so this is very analogous to, I guess, what Wheeler used to call charge without charge. You have a space-time which from a distance looks like it has charge, but there's no source for the charge. The metric is completely smooth and non-singular everywhere. And the charge is supported just by the non-trivial topology. So in this case, the strings, which were originally the source of the charge, are just replaced by flux. Now, these static bubbles that I wrote down are perturbatively stable. They can be thought of intuitively as vacuum bubbles that wanted to collapse. So remember I told you that there were sort of small bubbles that want to collapse. So you take one of those vacuum bubbles that would normally want to collapse, and then you put some flux on the sphere which wants to expand, and you can find an equilibrium point where the bubble is static and stable to small fluctuations. So our first three conditions are satisfied, but we still have to check the fourth, which was just that the size of the circle, this innocuous sounding condition, that the circle doesn't change its radius at infinity. And that's where we learn that not all black strings can decay to a static bubble. The reason is that when you demand sort of regularity at the bubble, this periodicity and the Euclidean time of the black hole, you learn that pi has to be identified with a definite period. So this is the result of the little calculation for the period that you have to have in the bubble given the original parameters r naught and alpha. Now the charge is also given as some other combination of r naught and alpha. So if you take the ratio of the charge over this length squared, you get a function of alpha which is bounded from above. Okay, it vanishes both at alpha equal to 0 and alpha equal to infinity. So you can satisfy this condition that the length of the circle is unchanged only if Q is small enough. So you can have a static bubble if the original black string had a small enough charge. If Q over L squared was less than a 1. But if the original Q over L squared is too big, there's just too much flux on that bubble, and it can't be supported. And when you decay to the bubble, it's going to necessarily expand out. Well, let me sort of demonstrate this in a little more detail. One can actually construct more general data for bubbles. So I'm now going to talk about just initial data for these solutions. There'll be time-symmetric initial data. And since I'm talking about six-dimensional bubbles, the initial data is on a five-dimensional surface. Okay. So let me consider a spatial metric, a five-dimensional spatial metric, which is spherically symmetric on three spheres, translationally invariant along this sort of Kaluza-Klein direction, and then the general metric can be put into this form in terms of two functions, u of rho and h of rho. The only constraint that I have to satisfy is the sort of scalar Einstein constraint. So that says the scalar curvature of this five-dimensional metric is equal to the energy density. And since the three form is essentially just the charge times the volume element on the three sphere, the h squared gives you a q squared over rho to the six type energy density. So we want to satisfy this one equation, and we have this general ansatz involving two functions, and there's clearly lots and lots of solutions. I can basically pick u arbitrarily and then solve this equation for h. Since I want to have a bubble, I want u to go to zero at some value of rho. If u has a simple zero at rho equal to rho naught, this is going to pinch off smoothly, and we'll get ourselves a bubble. So let me just pick u to be 1 minus rho naught squared over rho squared for some parameter rho naught, and then solve this equation for h, and this is the solution. Of course, it depends on rho naught, depends on the charge, and we have a free parameter b, a one-parameter family of solutions to this constraint equation. Well, you can use that freedom and that parameter b to fix the circle at infinity to be whatever you want. So b determines the size of the circle at infinity, and then you can ask, what's the mass of this initial data? And it turns out that the mass is given by a formula like this, and I've plotted it here as the mass of the function of rho naught. But to understand what's going on, let's first take q equal to zero. So let's turn off the charge and just look at this as vacuum data. Well, for vacuum data, the mass is going to grow initially like rho squared. So it comes up like rho squared. These small bubbles have bigger mass as you make them bigger. But then it reaches a maximum and turns over and falls off like minus rho naught to the fourth. And the mass becomes arbitrarily negative. So if q wasn't there, this point here at zero mass is the analog of Witten's bubble. That's the bubble which just sort of expands out. And this point up here, which is the sort of local maximum of the mass, is the static bubble. That's the analog of the sort of lower dimensional Euclidean black hole cross time. And you can see that the sort of smaller bubbles here would want to collapse down, and the bigger ones here wants to expand out. Now, what happens when you add the charge is that, of course, when you have a flux on the sphere doesn't want to get very small. There's going to be a lot of energy required to compress the flux. So that causes this mass to diverge when you go to rho naught equals zero. And therefore, you produce a stable or perturbatively stable minimum. And that's where these static black holes, bubbles that I was mentioning. And you might say, well, OK, that's fine, but you've only looked at this sort of two-parameter family of initial data. How do you know that there aren't, you know, more general perturbations that could destabilize this? Well, I don't have a rigorous proof of stability of these bubbles for all perturbations, but there is an argument, and let me just, before I get into the general argument, let me make one more comment. This is the picture for small charge, right? So this is the picture, as I've drawn it, for q less than L squared. If you add a little bit of charge, this part doesn't change, and it just turns over for small rho. But clearly, as I make q bigger and bigger, this minimum is going to grow. And eventually, it'll just completely, you know, this maximum and minimum will join, and you're not going to have any extremum at all. And so that's the problem. For large charge, when q is bigger than L squared, this mass becomes a monotonically decreasing function of bubble size, and there are no static bubbles at all. They just all expand out. OK, so that, as I said, was just a sort of illustrative example. If you want to really know whether these things are perturbatively stable, one has to do a more complicated analysis. And I haven't done it, so I can't give you a real proof. But there's an argument, which basically strings together a whole bunch of conjectures, which gives the right answer. So let me just tell you what the argument is. And if one of you gets inspired, I'd be delighted if you fill in all the gaps. OK, so here's the general argument that these bubbles should be perturbatively stable. So we start with a bubble, and we take any perturbation, and we expand it in modes. We have a Killing symmetry around the S1. So we can expand them in modes e to the ik chi, say. Now, if there's an unstable mode for some value of k, it seems likely that there is an unstable mode with k equal to 0. K is like a spatial momentum. It's going to add sort of to, you know, positively to omega. So it seems likely that if there's an unstable mode for non-zero k, there's probably an unstable mode for k equal to 0. That being an unstable mode will grow exponentially like e to the some constant a times t. So now we take that mode and analytically continue back to the black string and ask, what does that look like for the black string? Well, just doing our analytic continuation in reverse, under analytic continuation, this corresponds to a static perturbation because chi becomes our new time coordinate. But this dependence, e to the at, becomes some sort of oscillatory dependence along the string in e to the iax dependence. So we now have a static perturbation of the black string, which is sort of oscillating along the string. Now, perturbations of black strings have been extensively studied, starting with Gregory and Laflamme, you know, in the early 90s. And what they found was that very short wavelength perturbations are always stable, but long wavelength perturbations are sometimes unstable. This is the famous Gregory-Laflamme instability. If the long wavelength perturbations are unstable, there's got to be a critical wavelength in which there's a static perturbation, a non-trivial static perturbation, which is just on the border between the stable and the unstable modes. So conversely, since we're given a static perturbation, it indicates that longer wavelength perturbations are probably unstable. Okay. But there's another conjecture, originally due to Gupser and Mitra, and some version of it was proven by Harvey Rial, that a black string is unstable only if it has negative specific heat. In other words, if it's thermodynamically unstable, it will actually be unstable in general relativity to ordinary linearized perturbations. If it's thermodynamically stable, it should be stable to ordinary linearized perturbations. Well, actually, there was a paper yesterday providing a counterexample to this Gupser-Mitra conjecture, but the version that I need is actually the sort of subclass which was proven by Harvey, I believe, so I think I'm okay. So the last step in the argument is that the black string is unstable only if it has negative specific heat, but the black strings I'm starting with are near extremality, and these near extremal strings have positive specific heat. You can check that. So going backwards now, if it has positive heat, it can't have any unstable perturbations. If it doesn't have unstable perturbations, it can't have a static perturbation. If it doesn't have a static perturbation, then the original bubble can't have any k equals 0 unstable modes, and so it's probably stable. It's not a proof, I admit it, but at least it's a chain of arguments which gives one confidence that these things, or one might be able to prove that they really are stable. Okay. So that is the story for the black strings. And now in the rest of my time, I want to just mention a couple of other applications of this idea. So string theory turns out that it has not only one-dimensional extended objects surrounded, or one-dimensional extended objects, these strings, but there's also higher-dimensional extended objects, the brains, and there are black brains, which are just, again, higher-dimensional objects surrounded by horizon. And it turns out you can just look at the geometries of these charged brains that people have found, all solutions to various supergravity equations, and the similar story holds for almost all of them. Okay. When they're wrapped around a circle, the size of the circle decreases as you come in from infinity. And during Hawking evaporation, the size of the horizon will shrink down eventually reach the string scale. And at that point, the curvature at the horizon can still be small. Okay, that's a key point. So we don't need to worry about other possible complications from string scale curvature. The only stringy effect will be these winding tachyons, which will cause the instability and have the circle pinch off. And then with the right spin structure, in other words, if the fermions are anti-periodic around the circle, you will again produce a bubble.
Sorry, you say circle, there could be any cycle, right?
Sorry?
You said circle there, but it could be any cycle?
Well, I'm talking specifically now about winding strings becoming tachyonic. You can ask about brains, you know, higher brains wrapped around spheres and stuff, and ask if they become tachyonic when the spheres shrink down. But I don't know the analog of this anti-periodic boundary condition for the fermions. So I don't, you know, there's not an argument that those are going to become unstable. So for the moment, I'm really thinking about circles that are becoming small. OK, so the next two applications all involve anti-de Sitter space. So let me just remind you of the metric for anti-de Sitter space. Well, anti-de Sitter space, of course, can be written in many different types of coordinates. The so-called Poincaré coordinates gives you anti-de Sitter space in this form. So it's just r squared over this constant l squared times the flat Minkowski metric plus l squared over r squared times dr squared. And this script L is just the radius of curvature of ADS. These coordinates do not cover all of ADS globally. They cover just one patch of it. And to get even that patch, you need these sort of translational symmetries in the Minkowski space to be infinite. But of course, because they're symmetries, you can compactify them if you want. And if you do, then you get sort of conical singularity type singularities some sort of singularity at r equal to 0. So let me now mention two sort of applications of this in ADS. So one involves this three-dimensional black hole, which was discovered by Banados, Teitelbaum, and Zanelli, the BTZ black hole. It is just Einstein's equation in three dimensions is trivial. All solutions with negative cosmological constant have constant curvature. So this is locally just ADS3. But if you do an identification, in particular, you make this phi coordinate periodic, then you can write three-dimensional anti-de Sitter space in this way, which looks very much like a black hole with a horizon at this r naught hat. So we can see if this argument applies. And indeed, it does. It starts off very nicely, because if you consider fermions in ADS, it turns out that they're always anti-periodic. The fermions at infinity are always anti-periodic. So any black hole formed from collapse must have anti-periodic fermions around this circle. When r naught, well, this should be r naught hat, I guess. When this horizon radius reaches the string scale, these circles, phi, go to the string scale, and tachyon condensation will occur. So you expect those circles to pinch off. But there's something very different about this case and the other cases. If you're in three dimensions, space is just two-dimensional. And if you have a circle pinching off, the topology is just R2 again. It's just a disk. And that's the topology of original ADS. So in fact, when you pinch off the circle and you can construct the static bubble by analytic continuation, what you get back is exactly global anti-de Sitter space. It has constant curvature, the same topology as global ADS, and the static bubble is just ADS. There's nothing new there. And that might seem a little surprising, because it looks like you have a one-parameter family of black holes. But regardless of what you choose for r naught hat, whatever the horizon radius is here, you do an analytic continuation in T and in phi, the analog of the static bubble trick, and you get the metric of exact ADS3. OK, so the static bubble is ADS, and that's good. That's the ground state. So that's going to be a stability thing. You don't have any bubbles expanding off to infinity in this example. And furthermore, there's no bound analogous to the Q over L squared bound that we had in the asymptotically flat case, because in some sense, the size of the circle at infinity is already infinite. So there's no restriction there. So what this means is that if you form a black hole from collapse in three dimensions, and you form one of these BTZ black holes, they evaporate down to the string scale. And I should say there's no large curvature here. The curvature locally is set by this ADS radius script L, which can be, that can be a very large length scale and very low curvature everywhere. So when this horizon becomes small, there's not a large curvature there. So it evaporates down to a string scale horizon and then turns into ADS3 plus radiation. So you never actually reach this zero radius black hole, which is sometimes called the M equals zero black hole. The other example is the so-called ADS soliton. So if you periodically identify one direction in Poincaré coordinates in ADS5, as I said, the space has a singularity at the horizon at r equal to 0. And with antiperiodic fermions, there is a smooth lower energy solution, which was conjectured to be the ground state by Rob Myers and myself back in 98. And so this is the metric that we wrote down there, called it the ADS soliton. It was static. It's perfectly smooth. Asymptotically looks like, you know, periodically identified ADS 5. But you now recognize that this is very similar to those static bubbles. In fact, it can be obtained by analytic continuation from one of these black brains. So it's basically just a static bubble. And well, we conjectured that this was the ground state, and several people have looked into it. There's now growing evidence, I would say, that this is the case. Galloway has written several nice papers on this. But you know, it was always felt that there should be some mechanism by which periodically identified anti-de-Sitter could decay to this ground state. But didn't know of any mechanism until Eva Silverstein's work, because now we see that this tachyon in ADS, that when you compactify one of the directions, that circle will shrink down. When it reaches a string scale, it'll pinch off and actually produce this ADS soliton plus radiation. Okay. Well, I can just quickly mention a couple of other generalizations. I've talked about black strings with charges. You can add momentum to these strings if you want. Again, when the circle reaches the string scale, it should turn into a bubble. There's a little puzzle there, because bubbles intrinsically can't carry any momentum. When you make the identification to produce the bubble, it always has to be done in the rest frame of the bubble. So the bubble itself is sort of always at rest. If you have a black string with momentum and it decays to a bubble, that momentum must go into the radiation that's produced. Well, of course, the total charge is not changed. And rotation, you can have rotating black strings, and when you know they'll also produce bubbles, etc. So let me start with conclude with a couple of comments. It's often been said that when you have these tachyons associated with closed strings, and this instability should in some sense lead to a state of nothing. Okay, this is just an intuition which has been building up in string theory, that in some sense, when the sort of tachyons associated with closed strings arise, all the string states should suddenly become or become very massive, and there's no arena for them to propagate. And in some sense, our description in terms of ordinary space-time should be gone. And I mean, there's hints at that. I mean, I would say from various examples, but this is a very clear example of it. I mean, here we have a closed string tachyon, and it condenses, and we have literally nothing inside the bubble. The space-time is completely gone there. Another comment is that these Klutze-Klein bubbles of nothing were previously thought to require a non-perturbative quantum gravitational process. When Witten discussed them and various people followed up on it, they were thought to be extremely rare because, for any time the circle at infinity was much bigger than the Planck scale, you had to wait exponentially long times for them to arise. And this is now a qualitatively new way to produce them. So to summarize, we've seen that Hawking radiation plus this tachyon condensation will cause some black strings to turn into these Kaluza-Klein bubbles of nothing. These bubbles are charged and can be either static or expanding, depending upon how much charge they carry. And to give you a slogan to sort of take away for this talk, you can say that certain black holes catalyze the production of bubbles of nothing. And this was suggested to me by both Eva Silverstein and Lenny Susskind. The idea is that they're like defects. I mean, you have a state, this Kaluza-Klein vacuum, which would normally be very long-lived. The ordinary quantum decay is very slow. But you put a black hole in there and let it Hawking radiate, and you can nucleate one of these bubbles much faster. Well, there's an obvious next step. Okay, I've been talking about the exterior of the black string. And from the outside, you just have an ordinary black string. It Hawking radiates. You produce one of these bubbles. What happens if you fall in? Well, inside, you saw from the original metric that these circles go to zero size at the singularity. So if you fall in, you know, even initially, when the horizon is still large and the circle outside the horizons are all very large, the radius of the circle is going to shrink to zero at the singularity. So there'll come a time when it's the string scale. So that means that there is tachyon condensation taking place inside the horizon along a space-like surface when this reaches the string scale. Now, there was a paper just a couple months ago by McGreevy and Silverstein talking about an analogous problem in cosmology of tachyon condensation taking place everywhere on a space-like surface in a cosmological context. And it should be possible to match sort of that analysis or extend it and apply that inside the horizon and then combine that with this bubble formation outside to get a complete description of Hawking evaporation which is free of singularities. And that's work that's currently in progress with McGreevy and Silverstein. And so I should probably stop there. Thank you.
Questions?
Something.
Barry?
Many years ago, it was suggested long before Witten's paper by various people that a gravitating tachyon is precisely described by the same metric that he uses, because it has the same isometries as you'd expect in a tachyon. Instead of being spherically symmetric, it's Lorentz invariant.
Yeah. You're saying Witten's bubble was suggested to be a gravitating tachyon,
yes.
This analytic continuation.
So the question is, can one rephrase it and say that these black strings turn into tachyons?
Well, I wouldn't say that. Black strings turn into tachyons. I mean, a tachyon to me indicates some sort of instability. I mean,
well, this interpretation is if you have the idea of a tachyon as a space-like world line, as opposed to a time-like world line, then its symmetries are precisely the symmetries of the Kaluza line bubble. Whereas, of course, the symmetries of the Schwarzschild solution, which you get by analytic continuation, are precisely the symmetries of a time-like world line.
But I don't know. I mean, a tachyon, I think that there would be some source. I mean, you'd have some singularity along a line, a space-like line for the source of the particle, or I don't know. It doesn't look to me like a tachyon, but maybe someone else would.
Yeah. Could you just go back to the previous step about the black holes catalyzing?
This one?
Yeah. Is that something you should be worried about?
Yeah. Good question. Okay.
Well, I think the fact that we're not worried about it suggests that there are no such black holes.
Okay, well, we didn't know about it to be worried about it. But, okay, so you can ask how realistic these things are. And so that brings up a whole slew of issues. First of all, I would say the strongest evidence for taking this seriously is another paper that Eva Silverstein has written, which shows that in the so-called landscape of string theory, if you think about the various possible vacua of string theory, there are some in which the compact space you compactify on has circles with anti-periodic boundary conditions. So that sort of arises naturally in the sort of space of possible vacua of string theory. So if that's there in the theory, you could certainly wrap one of these black strings around it and produce some of these bubbles. There is a question of what would be the signature of one of these things. I mean, before you're actually, crashed, wiped out by the bubble, I've said that the production of the bubble releases a lot of energy. So you could try to do estimates of how much energy is released and see if you could set bounds on it from astrophysical observations. And I mean, I'm sure it's a long shot, but it's sort of fun to think about.
When you made your comment that you would have a description of Hawking evaporation without singularities, are you referring to just for these type of black holes, or are you trying to say that will be?
Okay, well, that's another good question, which we're thinking about. So the mechanism I discussed here is really tied to these winding tachyons. So you would need some sort of extended black hole, this sort of black string or black brain, to produce that. But there are some indications that a similar type mechanism might actually work for Schwarzschild, that just the spheres contracting inside Schwarzschild horizon might end up producing something analogous to this tachyon condensator state of nothing. I mean, those ideas are still vague, but it's possible that something like that will work out.
You don't expect those spheres of nothing to expand out afterwards into the universe.
I don't know.
if you imagine that somehow, and I think you have talked about this, that this radial modulus, for example, is stabilized, do these solutions still have similar properties that exist? You know, you might have thought that once you stabilize the radius, that this particular contraction might not occur, for example.
No, I don't think so. I mean, if you have some flux or something stabilizing the circle, like Eva's just arrived, she might want to comment on it, but I think she showed what happens. These things can still pinch off, and the flux gets, you know, converted to something else.
Well, the flux can end on a brain that wraps around the bubble, and although you might think the brain causes the bubble not to expand, that actually doesn't work out. It's the expansion is a stronger effect of the brain than
the stuff. Yeah, so maybe I just sort of explain that for a minute, because it's sort of a cute idea. So we have these bubbles expanding out, and you might say, well, maybe we could stop them from expanding by wrapping some brain around it, because if you have a two-sphere expanding out and you take a two-brain, it has tension, it would seem like it want to keep it in. But because this is sort of such low codimensionality, I mean, it looks like it's basically just a point mass in three dimensions, and in three dimensions, masses just cause conical deficit angles. So the metric that you would write down for a brain wrapping around a bubble is the same metric I've written down for these bubbles, just with a different periodicity for this circle producing a conical singularity on the bubble.
Well, so they still the question of the evaporation itself down to small radius. Whether is that?
Oh no, I don't think Hawking radiation is going to be shut off by.
Well, no, I don't think Hawking radiation will be shut off. But I wonder whether the configuration you shrink to really has a small radius, or maybe that's related to this other comment.
Well, I mean, the way he's getting the radius to be small is only locally near the black string, so he wraps a lot of black strings on the circle. Asymptotically, the circle can be big, stabilized by fluxes, but when you code in, it's small.
All right.
Because I understand it.
Any other questions? All right, thanks a lot.